Welcome to Tilth Talk Radio. Today we're going to be talking about the Endangered Species Act. In our spotlight, we'll take a look at a new, or well, I shouldn't say a new product, but a product of the year for 2024. Egg History Minute, we'll talk Endangered Species Act. Cool Beans, That's Corny, we'll have some current events, and we'll wrap things up with a Field Good Friday. With me today is Todd Schomburg.
Hey to all the Tilthies out there.
And I'm Matt Brueger, both with Tilth Agronomy. It's been a bit chilly lately, but at least we have snow now for at least the next few days until it warms up. We're supposed to see like 40s and 50s potentially next week, so we'll probably get a little bit of snow melt.
It's always this up and down, isn't it, Matt?
Yep.
Just flirting with that freezing, and then you get below zero for a while, and it was cold. Some mornings got cold, and I know talking to farmers out there, you always got, when you're dealing with cattle, you got waters freeze up, and you have just certain barns that always have these certain problems. In general, guys said though, and farmers said it wasn't too bad to get through this bout, but it was.
Yeah, we didn't have
snow. Seems to help
quite the extremes,
like right?
When we had the bare soil and like really significant negatives. It's funny how you get sick of being cold, you get sick of being warm, like if it's too warm.
Too hot, yeah. Yeah.
So it's the Goldilocks
issue. You just complain about it.
You've got to be just right.
You wonder where it's got to be somewhere in the lower Midwest, kind of somewhere in the middle of the United States that has this sort of the Goldilocks zone of like not too hot, but obviously enough of those areas do get hot. They're very humid. Or not too cold, where...
Yeah, I mean, I'd be interested to see, because this year in particular, the places you think of like, oh, I'll just go to, Florida, Arizona, wherever. Florida got snow.
Right.
At the end of January. So did, like, New Orleans, that southern Louisiana, parts of Texas, and so yeah, I don't know that you're safe anywhere after the, like this year.
It does feel like
it's going to snow. Like if we don't get the really cold weather, just go somewhere else. But I mean, while we were in California, it wasn't too bad at the conference we went to, but.
Yeah, depending how close you are to certain water systems and
on the water,
lakes probably, and oceans, it can help but hurt at the same time. So the biggest complaint I'm getting from my kids is that the snow when it's coming is on weekends, so they haven't gotten snow days. They did have one, because I think so far they've had one. Yeah, one day, and they had one snow day as well, didn't they? Because that was kind of called ahead of the storm a little bit.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Yep.
So, but otherwise, it's been more on, not around times where you're going to cancel school.
Yeah, the snowmageddon that didn't come the first time.
Yes, right.
Versus this last time, I think we got more.
Quite
a bit more snow.
It was very fluffy snow, which made it nice to handle. However, it was still a lot. It was still a lot of snow that if that would have been a wet snow, that would have been pretty tough stuff to push around and deal with.
I hate wet snow. And maybe I just need a new snowblower, but like to shovel it sucks. And you can wreck your shovel real easy. And I've got an older snowblower and it just like, it'll do fine for a while, but then all of a sudden it'll just like get packed up.
Yeah, it always gets
in the chute, and then it's like, and then you got to sit there and like turn it off.
And try not to lose your arm. And,
well, yeah, that's why I turn it off.
Yeah.
Before I stick my arm in there. And you like get that plug of just solid wet snow out of there. And then you can go again for a little while, and it's like, I should just shovel this. But like, nope, it's too heavy to shovel.
Yep.
It's too packy to snowblow. I guess I need like some sort of plow.
In your neighborhood, do you guys play that roulette of... Because in the country, this was not a thing. But when you live somewhere where you got closer neighbors, it's a thing where, like, somebody come, like, the half pay it forward, half pay it backward in this tricky, like, how do you
rotate through and like do each other's driveways.
This guy snowblowed my driveway, so I'm going to do that one. And
we do not have it in our.
No, that's probably good. Once that starts, it's a like never ending. Like you either feel bad that you didn't help out a neighbor, or yeah, it's just tricky of what happens.
Yeah, the only time I had anything like that was my neighbor came over once when we first moved into our house, and I had shoveled, and I think we were supposed to get a bunch more snow. He's like, "Do you want me to just kind of like snow blow the piles so that you have room to?" Because I've learned that over the years of shoveling, that just shoveling the driveway can be a bad idea in years where you get a lot of snow.
Right, because you get the piles next.
Get too high.
Well, on the farm, that's part in the rural communities. That is the hard part. Is once you get those piles so big and you don't. That first snow, if you don't create enough room for yourself to push the rest, but you don't know how much more is coming always, you need to know. And yes, you're right, that can be tricky.
Yeah, so I appreciated that because I remember if our snowblower wasn't working or if I didn't have one at that time. But yeah, it was just kind of one of those things where I had that experience, but otherwise, no. It's no one randomly does snowblow my driveway.
Yeah, okay.
So,
like I said, good and bad.
Yes, I can see the ups and downs to that.
Yeah. Oop, there is four cities that it says are the best, most moderate climate in like different areas.
Okay. So where's the Goldilocks zone?
And these are in the Midwest, because it goes by region, which actually makes sense.
Yeah.
Because it kind of says they're not, but in the Midwest, Kansas City, Missouri is considered the best weather. In the Northeast, it's Boston, Massachusetts, one... To me, that would be interesting because they get
as told by Bostonians, in their opinion,
in the sort of the West would be Seattle, would be the Northwest, would be Seattle, Washington, and then when you go to the Southeast, it's Miami, Florida, and then kind of the overall winner supposedly is San Diego, California. That San Diego,
I think it's pronounced San Diego.
Diego, thank you. The San Diego is kind of average temps of 60 to 70, winters that are cool, but summers that are warm but not scorching. So, like, not kind of a... And what's interesting is, like, when we were out in Monterey, one of our Uber drivers said San Diego is, like, the best.
Yeah.
He said, remember him saying, like, no, just go to San Diego. It's the best, so...
Yeah, I could see some butts with a few of those, like Seattle, Washington... Yeah, maybe it's not doesn't get super cold, but you got to deal with the rain.
It rains all the time, right?
And then Boston, you got to deal with the Celtics and there's really nothing wrong with Boston teams, but
even Boston, it gets
most people don't
quite
care for
cold. In the winter. You know what I mean? Yeah. Like it's an interesting one to pick. I thought they'd pick somewhere like when you say Northeast, like a little further to the south there than that one.
Because Boston, I feel like, is one of those places where it's not like snow. They get snow, and it's not like pretty snow, like, you know, Vermont. Think of those, it's like the little cottage in the woods with the smoke coming out of the chimney. Like, you don't think about it with that with Boston.
No.
Miami, I get, other than, you know, people trying to eat your face off. That would be the downside to Florida. I've been to San Diego a long time ago. And it was nice.
The one thing I remember about San Diego is, like, during the day, it would actually get, like, kind of hotter than you. Like, the actual fluctuation during the day was quite, like...
Sure.
It got hot enough where it's like, whew, you got to probably dress... Like, a lot of places, you got to dress in layers. But there, it seemed like... During the day, it got warm where you're like... But at night, it felt cold then because of how warm it got or something. So,
well, it's all relative. I mean, you can go to a, you know... We can go from our, you know... -5 to somewhere where it's only like 40 degrees and it'll feel a lot warmer and people there are in winter coats and acting like the world's going to end because it's almost freezing.
Ever. Yeah.
So it's all relative. All right. You ready to get into our topic for today?
So this has been a fun one to sort of research and watch the track, because if we talk about where we're at, to me, this is really just hitting the sort of the agriculture news right now, but we've been watching it for 3 years.
Yeah. No.
When was the first you kind of heard about? Maybe for me, it hasn't been all 3 years. It's probably been a year and a half, something like that.
I would say we've talked about it, like, trying to think what city the National No-Till Convention was at. But it wasn't, it was at least 2 years ago. It came up there, NAICC. It's come up at that conference the last few years.
Yes, the National Alliance of Independent Crop Consultants has been on kind of the leading edge. That group has really been
and WSSA
talking about
has
it.
Been on it.
Yes,
too.
Them too. The
Weed Science,
the Weed Science
Society of America.
Yeah, and I know and farm groups as well in general have been kind of working this. But for this might be to farmers out there, this might be the first time they even hear of this change and know what's going on. So that our goal today is just to explain to farmers what's going on. What's changed? What does that mean for you as a farmer? And so basically it has to do with the Endangered Species Act. And in 2022, the EPA, or the Environmental Protection Agency, announced that it was adopting a new policy on how it would meet its Endangered Species Act obligations. So basically, the Endangered Species Act has not changed that part of it.
Right. We didn't re-legislate the Endangered Species Act.
Yes, and maybe parts of it have changed, but how this happens has not changed. But the way that EPA to create labels for products has changed. So when carrying out actions under the Federal Insecticide, Fungicide, and Rodenticide Act, so FIFRA, we'll call it, people heard of FIFRA, but when they're going to make a new label or relabel something, the way that they meet their obligations of ESA has changed. So that's one thing to think about. A lot of this is going to get talked about on Endangered Species Act, it's going to get brought up, but really, not to say it doesn't have anything to do with that, but that didn't change. It's the way that really FIFRA changed, or the way that they've met that. And in general, what started this was when we lost a lot of our dicamba products.
Right.
And courts sort of pulled labels. They pulled them on the basis that the label wasn't meeting the Endangered Species Act at times. So what the EPA has done is changed that so that hopefully in the future we can make sure we're meeting those obligations and we don't get labels pulled.
Yeah, we don't want to see tools vacated.
No, that was the way it happened stinks. Was difficult for farmers. Yeah, that was frustrating. I mean, so that's why and what changed. So as you hear more about this, I think that's important to have that kind of groundwork with that. And we've talked about different groups. One of the groups we're a part of, the National Alliance of Independent Crop Consultants, they've been kind of working with this. In the summer of 2024, they held a bus tour to kind of show some people from EPA, Fish and Wildlife, and other agencies. They took them around to different farms in Wisconsin and showed them how this would affect their farm. So, one farm, and I'm forgetting what endangered species they all dealt with.
So here in Wisconsin, it's the rust patch bumblebee, the eastern Mosaga rattlesnake.
Yep, I forgot about that rattlesnake. Yeah,
those two are the big ones. There's talk of the monarch getting listed, but it is currently not. So that's a potential future one. And then you can go on the website. I know there's a few other ones that are in the state, but rusty patch is kind of the first one I remember hearing about and has been kind of hit on. And then, to the southeast, that's where the eastern Mosaga rattlesnake has been an issue. So those are the two species I think I've heard the most about in regards to these changes. So it's one of those things where as we move into this new system that we're going to talk about, just knowing where those species are, where their habitats are, and if you have them, is kind of the important part. And that's the Bulletin's Live 2's part of this, is they've had that out. It's been going for a while. And it's a place you can look to see if you have I'm not sure why, but this next term sticks in my head a lot lately. PULA, which is a pesticide use limitation area.
Okay.
Like, PULA. You got to look for the PULA. Are you in the PULA?
sounds like a drink.
Yeah, it does.
Like that, I'm going to belly up to the bar and, you know, right next to the pool and
drink
order
in the pool. Yeah.
Yes. Okay. So Matt's right with the first step is to know if a mitigation is even required. You can Google up this bulletins live too. And it's kind of, it's TWO.
It's TWO. Yes. It's not, the number two.
It's
not
the second version, I guess, but
not also.
One thing with that website is it kind of pulls you up to a map. And then you could click around your location or your field locations, and then it'll tell you different things. For some reason with that website, Matt, I do find it, I don't want to say clunky, but tricky sometimes. Of I'll click my location, and then to find out what I really have to do, there's like a bunch of links on the side then. And I can't always seem to, and I know as things change, that's the point, is this is supposed to be a bulletin and live, obviously, so things are going to change. So the requirement is that 6 months before an application, you're supposed to check this website to see if it's changed, because things can change. So
right.
It's not like you have to check, you know, a month before or right before, you know, the day before every application. It says 6 months before. So right now you could go check it, and then that would cover you for a lot of your applications. For this year, obviously, till, you know, this, right now it's February, so that would get you into August for different applications you're going to use. But so this website would be one to familiarize yourself with, because, like I said, it has a map. It's got like a bunch of different colorings on it,
and you can search by location, so you can put in your location, like the nearest town to you, or whatever would make the most sense. And then, yeah, it'll identify the pula you're in, if you're in one at all. There are some areas currently on the map that don't necessarily have a defined pula.
And like, yes, where we are, Tilth headquarters, we are not in a pula.
But like Todd mentioned, it's right now mostly what's on there is the dicamba stuff.
So right.
It kind of stems back from that.
Right. And that's what's going to be interesting with this, is like it could get to be... This is just the start of it. So, as we go further, you're probably going to search by location and then potentially by product that you're going to apply, because
right.
It's going to be specific to those products. So then that's sort of the first step. The next step is what do we got to do about it? So what's going on right now is the first and currently kind of the only product that we deal with that has a herbicide strategy is Liberty Ultra.
Yep, and this was a recent labeling, so it's kind of the test subject for this system is Liberty Ultra here.
So as new products come out, as products get relabeled, then on their label you'll actually see new parts of these labels that will have to do with a herbicide strategy specifically for meeting the requirements of ESA. So if you look at the label, let's go right specific to Liberty Ultra. There is now a Section 11 mandatory runoff mitigation. So they're going to have some things on the labels that like literally you can't. So the first two things are do nots. So do not apply when soils are saturated or above field capacity, and do not apply during rain. So there's going to be some given things that just you cannot do to meet their ESA guidelines. And then basically it gets into how many points you need to achieve a status of, you know, using the product, and it's a point-based system. So we'll get into that next. So basically... go ahead, Matt.
I was just saying, and it's Liberty Ultra is not, it's new but not new. So they changed the formulation. That's why it went through kind of this process. So it'll apply to any product that has to go through a relabeling process. So it's not necessarily that it's only new chemistries. it's going to be existing chemistries that go through this process again because of changes. So in this case, it's glufosinate, and I think they, it's now considered, instead of just glufosinate, it's glufosinate P, I think is what I, if I read that correctly. So it's not a not a wholly new product necessarily. It's just kind of a reformulation type thing. So
I was trying to find a list of like current, and I know they said it at a meeting we were at, but what are the herbicides currently being, you
right,
know,
what are, what's
reconsidered?
And
I, one, I couldn't remember any. Two, I didn't quickly find a kind of a list. But I think we'll, that'll be the next thing, is the way this comes out is going to be somewhat slowly roll out. It's going to be a, definitely a soft launch, because
right, they're not going to apply it to every label right now.
Right. So that part of this with farmers, you're going to hear about it in the news right now. And then it's almost going to feel like it went away unless you spray Liberty Ultra this year. So it,
and I have seen a couple articles regarding this specific label that, you know, oh, they snuck it in. And for some people, it probably does.
Well, like snuck it in the label.
Yeah, like some, for some people, it maybe feel that way. But like Todd and I said, you know, it's been talked about for the last few years. It's not, this isn't something that just came out of nowhere completely.
No, and I would say in general,
it just hasn't been well reported on.
We've seen meetings with, where BASF and Corteva and Bayer, you know, they say the chemical companies are there at the same time with EPA and other ones. And I think there's, you know, obviously some tension, but in general, it was like the EPA was also working with BASF on this label. Like,
yeah. These companies want their products labeled, so they want right, to make sure they're doing what they need to do to keep the technology not only getting its label, but also to stay labeled. Like we mentioned, we don't want to see vacation products get vacated again in the future. And I know I've seen some stuff on from BASF that, you know, they're going to be doing some trainings and some other things. So there, more information is going to be coming in regards to this whole situation. It's just with this being the first label, this is, like we said, it's going to be kind of the rollout. There's going to be a lot of information probably thrown out in the next, you know, 6 months here in regards to how it's going to get used in the growing season and all that kind of stuff. So that's kind of why we want to talk about it now.
Right. So specific to Liberty's label, it says right on here, you must achieve a minimum of 3 points for the crop uses listed on this label, unless otherwise stipulated below. And there isn't really many stipulations that I found that really would kind of change that. So basically, to use this product, we got to get 3 points of mitigation to be able to use this product. So that's kind of like, we're trying to kind of do this stepwise, but really the end game for a farmer is going to be figuring out how many mitigation points you have on your farm or on a field. It's going to probably be pretty much by field. So you may have to, once you figure out the points, though, unless something drastically changes, they're going to be similar year to year.
Right.
So the next step then is after, you know, you see I'm going to use this herbicide and now I got to get these mitigation points, is going to the EPA has a mitigation menu website. So it's epa.gov/pesticide/mitigation-menu. And it's a great website, and you can really just Google it of just ESA mitigation menu, and you'll get there. But I put on sort of like my dad's farm just to see how many points we'd get and what we get. It, when you first get to the website, it actually seems quite daunting because there's a whole bunch going on. It's a bunch of charts, hyperlinks. It just feels like it's, but once you take 5 minutes to digest it, it's actually, it's quite good because it's robust and it'll get you out of places. But if you just want to do what you need is just the, to figure out how many points. So there's a spreadsheet you can download, and then that'll kind of take you another spot. But there's also a bunch of explanation of the mitigation points.
Yes. No, like we were talking before, you can really fall down a rabbit hole of digging into these links and, you know, different explanations. And there's probably going to be revisions. I mean, like with this being the first kind of run at it, there's things that will probably change as we move forward, as they see how implementation goes. But in general, it's a mix of a lot of different ways that you can can gain these points. And some of them are things you're probably already doing, things that are going to be good for applications in terms of efficacy. Because I know one of the things that's been talked about at meetings is, you know, it's boom heights and drift retardant agents and, you know, things like that. And it's things we probably should be doing to maximize our use of these products anyway. So it's not just like, oh, they're going to make us jump through all these different hoops. There's a lot of different things that you can get points for that are things, like I said, you're either already probably doing or should be doing. So,
and the big thing for you, so for a farmer listening out there, go download the spreadsheet, and it's quite simple. You just punch in kind of the name, date, you know, field, and then you start going down different categories. So sort of the first category is how much, like the buffers, like how far are you to certain things and that. And if you meet a certain buffer requirement, you can get some points based on that. The next category is, it says systems of capture runoff discharge. So like if you've got a retention pond, sediment control basin, something that's catching some of that runoff, you can get points for that. The biggest one of what we noticed, Matt and I, was this pesticide runoff vulnerability. So depending on the county you're in, you're going to kind of either get some like bonus points or no points based on that. And Matt, you found that it was kind of based on rainfall, it seemed.
Yeah, the way the map kind of read for that particular thing is that, so they have a whole U.S. map. If you follow the links going into it, it's nice they have the county list, but if you want to see the big picture, it shows and basically says their relief points are based on levels of rainfall, which leads to susceptibility of runoff and erosion. And so the less rainfall you get, less potential for that erosion, it requires less mitigation.
So like in Wisconsin, the county we're in Outagamie, we'd get 2 mitigation points, kind of relief points, they call them, because you just, your chance of having a problem is less.
And we're already halfway there.
Yeah.
We only need
so
3.
You're right. So just by that, we were able to get points. Other counties that are a little more sandy, it seems, because Waupaca, our neighbor to the west, they'll get 3 points just for being Waupaca County. They get that just for being them. So depending the area, and if you look at the map, especially out west where it's real dry, so if they're in the very dry category, they're going to get an automatic 6 points. It wasn't a lot of counties, but some of the real, real dry ones. And then if you're very wet and have a lot of, so kind of from, I would say, what would you say, Matt? Like halfway down in Iowa, kind of down through Missouri. And
yeah, like central Iowa through Missouri, down into Louisiana, and then it kind of starts to taper off as you head toward eastern Tennessee, Kentucky.
Yeah, they're basically going to get 0 points, so they don't get any kind of bonus or whatever you'd want to call it, because they've got a high runoff vulnerability in a lot of those counties. So just that alone, that first thing might change, you know, depending how vulnerable what you're in, could change what you need right away. So next they get into basically if you're tracking this or not, you get a free bonus point. So if you do this spreadsheet and track it, you just get like a bonus point to do it. So
okay, so we're done, right?
So right. So for Liberty Ultra, we already hit that amount of points we need. We did. For other chemistries, it seems like in general certain chemistries might need up to like 8 points ish. Even 9 potentially, but so, you know, you may need for other things that come out, you may need to keep going. Some of the other things are field slope. So like here we, and it's under 3%. So it's a pretty flat slope in general, but that's not crazy. I mean,
no, yeah.
So here at Tilth headquarters, we would meet that. So we'd get a 2-point bonus for that. And then predominantly sandy soils, you'd get a bonus as well. And that is of 2 points. So, but it is really sandy. It's sand, loamy sand, or sandy loam. So those are pretty sandy. You know,
and,
we're talking.
And there is a but to that. And then, because it's that option can only be used if the product label does not prohibit application on sandy sure. soil. So if there's, it's, you know, this isn't end all be all. You still have to read the label.
Right.
So if you have, if there are restrictions on sandy soils, you may or may not get that one.
Get that one. Yep. And then we get into like in-field mitigation, so tillage and contour farming, vegetated strips, and then irrigation. So the big two here that we'll talk about is just tillage. So if you're no-till, you'll get 3 points. And if you're kind of like a reduced till, you get 2 points. That one I got to look into a little bit more, you know, what reduced tillage really means, like how low. But there's a potential for some points. And then the irrigation one, Matt and I were talking about this one. And it if basically if you have irrigation, you don't get any points. But if you don't have irrigation at all, so non-irrigated lands, you get like 3 points for that, for not being irrigated. So basically they're kind of watching that, you know, if you have irrigation, you have a higher potential. But if you do use water management through irrigation, so you kind of do certain things like soil moisture meters, you're going to get 2 points, and using drip tape and kind of like different sprinkler, micro sprinklers, you're going to potentially get points from that as well. So yep. Here where we're non-irrigated, there's another 3 points for us. And then if you've got measures field adjacent, grass waterways, filter strips, any kind of filtering devices that way, you can get points. And then kind of the last one right now is just other mitigation practices, but I think that's not quite been... I think the other part to talk about, these will change over time,
right?
Potentially in point values, potentially in... So when you run it for a field, it's not probably going to change all that much unless you add something into that field. But the point structure or I think you're going to see more mitigation measures potentially on here too over time. So basically, right there, Matt, we got around, it says 10 points that we've got. So you know, run this for your farm, then you know how many points you got, and maybe you know certain fields where you got to add a practice or two to meet it or not. So complicated yet simple all at the same time, because I do think learning it, working with your agronomist, working with your co-op, that's the other part, I guess, Matt. Who do you, if what is, I don't think has been hashed out, is who's going to have to do this. So if you pay a co-op to spray your fields, do they got to figure this out for you? Are they going to work with you? Probably a little of both. But if you spray your own, you know, you're probably going to be in charge of making sure this is right with your agronomist. So making sure you communicate that
right
in the future here, and who needs to do what. And
yeah, I think it's going to be a mix. Even if you don't spray your own, I'm sure you're still going to have some liability to make sure that the person who does your spraying, whether it's a neighbor, co-op, to make sure that they're doing what they need to do. Unfortunately, it feels like every time we get somewhere, the farm ultimately still holds some liability, it regardless of like who's that. Doing right. the applications. And
right.
So it'd be good to stay ahead of some of this stuff. Like we said, the points are going to matter. Reading labels is going to matter. And ultimately, it's going to come down to what kind of risks you have. It's kind of like doing a risk assessment on the farm of what are the chances this leaves the farm, gets into the water, gets anywhere else.
It drifts. To where it drift is a big drift, part of this.
Yeah, it gets out of the field.
Trying to make sure it's safe. So I do think the one good thing about what the future of this is that it is going to be kind of slowly implemented over time, like we talked about as new labels come on. So what a farmer should do now is probably get yourself used to that bulletins live to site, and then also that mitigation site, and run it on a few of your fields this year so you know how well you're sitting with points. You know that, okay, as labels come out, like, well, no, I'm already good. I got 8 points on all my fields. I'll be fine, you know, or... No, shoot, I'm, you know, some of these where I've got maybe irrigation and other certain things, like I'm only at, you know, 4 points. I got to do something to to change that in the future so that I'm ready as a product that I use gets relabeled.
Yeah, and there's other things in here that we didn't mention because where we are, we don't deal with much slope, but, you know, farming on contour has point values. There's other things in here that can might affect your farm that don't affect where we are right now, the way we kind of ran this. And one of the things I'm hopeful for that was discussed in some of the meetings and informational sessions we've attended in regards to ESA is there's talk of trying to get some labeling standardization in the industry. So when you look at a label,
that'd be awesome.
Right. No,
it'd be the best. In a way, I'm surprised that hasn't already happened, that there isn't some standardization to that standard. But
right.
To know, like, I can go to Section 11 and it's always going to be the same, whether it's this company or that company. And I mean, you and I have seen enough labels, man. Some are, I think the smallest label I remember is about 8 or 12 pages. You know, it's low single digits up to their 30 or 40 pages. And
yeah, it's always fun when you're standing there trying to read it on the jug.
Right. And
it's about a 2x3 label that's like really fine print. So yeah, it would be nice if that does happen. Don't know that there's a timeline for it or any of that kind of stuff, but as someone who reads labels every year, that would be fantastic to see some standardization of how these things are laid out. So it's just going to make things easier for all of us. So there you go. There's another quick primer on the Endangered Species Act and kind of where we're going with products as Liberty Ultra begins its rollout as the first really affected label. Now we'll move into our spotlight today. So the Scoop did a best new product released in 2024. And this year it is Awaken Flow Boost from Loveland. So you might wonder, what is Awaken Flow Boost? Because it's not, the name is not like necessarily.
Sounds like some sort of like energy shake I drink in the morning.
Yeah.
Like, right.
Yeah, really gets your gut going.
Yep. Yeah. Like, yeah, probiotics, a lot of protein.
You can drink coffee or you can drink your Awaken Flow Boost.
Yes. I don't drink this.
Don't. No, it's not good for you necessarily. So it's a seed treatment product, which adds a talc graphite spec to it. So as people are getting away from talc and graphite for a lot of different reasons, they went with a corn-based product and recognized it as a growing market space and an opportunity for us to bring something to our growers that is unique and from an agronomic standpoint makes a lot of sense. So the benefits of Awaken Flow Boost benefits are twofold, seed singulation and flowability. The product is applied at planting and maintains a 99% effective use rate as seeds are flowing through the planter, which is comparable to a standard 80-20 talc graphite mix. And it has a micronutrient package, which is 5% phosphate, 1% iron, 3% manganese, 2.5% molybdenum, and 10.5% zinc, which helps mitigate stresses that come with planting early in cold, wet soils. So according to the company, these advantages brought growers improved yield, test weight, and moisture across all geographies during the product's first official year on the market. Trials they have seen range anywhere from a 4 to 6 to maybe even up to 8 bushel difference. Case McDaniel, Vice President of Loveland Products, adds that quicker emergence was also a common result due to the product's micronutrient pack. So Awaken Flow Boost could be something you might want to try on a limited basis. I mean, obviously, if what you're doing is working, it has the potential to maybe add something to it, but it's not necessarily guaranteed that it's going to make things better. So it sounds interesting, and look forward to seeing more about how it works out in the field. Now we'll move into our Ag History Minute. So since we're talking Endangered Species Act and its effect on labels, we thought we'd talk about the act specifically. So the Endangered Species Act of 1973 is the primary law in the United States for protecting and conserving imperiled species, designed to protect critically imperiled species from extinction as a consequence of economic growth and development, untempered by adequate concern and conservation. The ESA was signed into law by President Richard Nixon on December 28, 1973. The Supreme Court of the United States described it as the most comprehensive legislation for the preservation of endangered species enacted by any nation. Purpose of the ESA was twofold: prevent extinction and to recover the species to the point where laws protections are not needed. It therefore protects species and the ecosystems upon which they depend. Endangered Species Act is administered by two federal agencies, the United States Fish and Wildlife Service and the National Marine Fisheries Service, the NMFS. The NMFS handles marine species, and Fish and Wildlife, or the FWS, has responsibility over freshwater fish and all other species. Act distinguished two grades of species for listing: endangered and a lesser category of threatened. Endangered species in danger of extinction. A threatened species faces such a threat in the foreseeable future. And as of this month, February 2025, there was a total of 742 animal species listed as endangered and threatened on the list. So, there you go.
Good. Thank you, Matt.
The more you know.
The more you know. You kind of know what endangered and threatened mean, but the threatened is this, like, the foreseeable future. I know that's got to be hard for them to define.
I imagine there's probably some sort of criteria of decline in population. But
and I believe monarch, if they list it, it'll be on the threatened list first, right? So, I would guess they'd get to that list first and then hopefully keep them from getting on the endangered list, and how that all works. But yes, this faces a threat in the foreseeable future. All right. Thank you, Matt. And thank you to our listeners out there. Please subscribe to the podcast and tell a farmer friend. It's really easy. Just search Tilth Talk Radio in Apple Podcasts, or on your Android phone, go to an app like Podcast Addict. And there you can also search Tilth Talk Radio and you'll find us. And you can also listen on your computer or smartphone browser. Go to tilthag.com/podcasts. You can follow us on Facebook and X at Tilth Talk Radio.
All right. Thanks, Todd. Now it's time to get into some current events. So Cool Beans, and that's corny.
Cool Beans.
You're jumping.
I know. Time. I was trying to do more than one.
More than one.
Beans, and I should just settle down.
Cool Beans. All right. Our Cool Beans this week: cow's milk continues to remain superior. So plant-based beverages such as soy and almond products are dairy milk's biggest imposters, often served with the same promised benefits of cow's milk. Gaining popularity within recent years among the younger generations, many have forgotten that cow's milk is also known as nature's most nearly perfect drink. Bovine milk is the only beverage that provides humans with almost all the nutrients we need to maintain a healthy lifestyle. Yet some stray away from dairy as they choose to consume nut, soybean, grain, and vegetable beverage alternatives. So, a Splash Milk News update, authored by Lauren Milligan Newark, highlighted research that evaluated 200 different plant-based beverages from 21 different brands, comparing them with cow's milk, low-fat in this case. While some of the plant-based beverages came close nutritionally, it was found that these beverages were highly variable in nutrient content, especially when it came to fortified vitamins and minerals such as B12, vitamin D, and of course calcium, when compared to cow's milk. Using an imputation approach, which I'm not sure what that means, researchers estimated the nutrient content of listed ingredients in these plant-based offerings after analyzing 175 nutrients, nutrient ratios, and other food components compared to milk's daily values. It was noted that Americans may be at risk for under or overconsumption of these components. The U.S. adults generally do not get enough vitamin D, calcium, potassium, dietary fiber, protein, and vitamin B12. Plus, women of reproductive age often don't get enough iron, while they may overconsume saturated fats, sodium, and added sugars. So the most variable nutrient was vitamin B12. And says that one cup of low-fat milk provides roughly 50% of the adult's daily value for B12. Only 36% of plant-based beverages evaluated provided at least 80% of the vitamin B12 provided by a serving of low-fat cow's milk. Also found that though a small portion of plant-based beverages provide 100% daily value of vitamin B12, 52.5% of those beverages had no vitamin B12 at all. This is not a shocking find, as some milk alternatives are known to offer little or no health benefits when compared to cow's milk. So you had another reason to enjoy a nice cold glass of milk.
I didn't know B12 was that.
Yeah, it's a big one for, I think, immune health.
It says red blood cells, and nervous system, red blood, yeah. DNA and RNA synthesis. Yeah, got to get that B12.
Yeah. So there you go. Now we'll move to our That's Corny this week. So what is the true cost of what farmers are arguing is a broken immigration system in the U.S.? Well, President Trump's focus on mass deportation is creating a sense of nervousness that hasn't been felt since the Obama administration. Yet the bigger concern is a H-2A system that has become too costly for many farmers to use. So situated in the west side of the San Joaquin Valley, Joe Del Bosque is a first-generation farmer in Central California, son of migrant workers. He conquered the American dream by starting his own farming operation in California in 1985. My father was a farm manager, so I grew up on the farm doing exactly what I'm doing today, he said. He grows organic melons, including cantaloupes, honeydew, watermelons. He also grows organic processing tomatoes, as well as almonds and cherries. Del Bosque is one of the largest, if not the largest, melon grower for Whole Foods. He says a lot has changed in the 40 years of running his own farm, but what hasn't changed is the fact that most of what he produces on his operation has to be hand-picked. Melons are highly perishable. When they're ready, they've got to be picked. And he said if a crew would miss even a couple days' work, the farm would be at risk of losing a crop. So they heavily rely on seasonal labor. His produce is ready to be harvested between June and October, and during those crucial months, he relies on 150 seasonal employees to help pick fruit. We have scaled back, he said. I would say 6 or 8 years ago, we were at probably 300 to 350 employees. But between water issues and the switch from conventional farming to organic, which has reduced their acres, he now employs half of what he did 8 years ago. And still, one of his biggest challenges is finding enough labor. It's not been easy, but we have found enough labor. We try to focus mostly on local labor. Doesn't mean they're not immigrant labor. They are immigrants who just live locally. And so they have crews that come from Arizona, but one thing that they are not able to find as much of is seasonal labor that would come from Mexico for a few months and then go home. So there was tightening of the border during the Obama administration, and sometimes both people couldn't come anymore. And so that's why we try to focus on getting more people that live permanently here in the U.S. But there's a struggle with labor shortages for himself and other farmers while with mass deportations in his community. So again, with the current border tightening, it's causing lots of trouble finding new labor.
Yeah, hopefully we can get the H-2A program, you know, continuing to evolve that program into helping out farmers getting the labor they need when they need it, and making that system a way to get here legally would be a huge benefit for farmers.
All right, now we will move into our Feel Good Friday. So today we're swinging down to the southwest, to the state of Iowa. Mission complete. An Iowa man has eaten a pork tenderloin in all 99 Iowa counties. So when JJ...
I love this story. Did we ask for this? No.
No. But
is it still awesome? Yes.
Not all heroes wear capes. Okay.
Yes.
And with a name like JJ, it's got to be powerhouse, right? So when JJ Goodvin revealed his quest to eat a pork tenderloin in all 99 Iowa counties, there were certainly a lot of people asking the question, is he for real? I focused on pork tenderloins because it's probably the most popular sandwich in Iowa, said Goodvin, who serves as a chief explorer of the Iowa Gallivant. I knew it was going to be huge, but I didn't realize it was going to be this huge. It took off from video one. People are like, holy crap, this guy is doing it. So since starting his Tenderloin tour 10 months ago, Goodvin's videos have accumulated more than 28 million views across his social media platforms. He said he made a tentative list of where we were going to go, but his list has changed probably 50 times because we let the locals guide us. Locals very, very rarely steer you wrong. Paid attention to the comments every single time we put up a pork tenderloin. There were always comments with other places we should go to. Engagement was unbelievable. So who has the best pork tenderloin, you might ask? Well, on February 13th, he planned to announce his favorite tenderloin of all 99 counties. He visited from his first tenderloin in April from Bax's Sutliff store and tavern in Sutliff in Johnson County to his last at Smoke and Firehouse number 20 in Ringstead in northern Iowa's Emmett County on January 19th. It's an experience he'll always remember.
So yes, that it was revealed. It was the Landmark Bistro of Grundy Center, Iowa.
Is that in Grundy County?
It's got to be.
It's got to be Grundy County.
Yeah. Oh, that's awesome. It's even in a country song.
Is there an auction?
There definitely.
At that location in Grundy County. He went down to the Grundy County auction, got himself pork tenderloin. So there you go.
Yeah, it's very near Waterloo.
Okay.
The Landmark Bistro. So maybe, how far are we here? That's hard to tell.
See if
it's not too far. I mean, it's right in the middle of the state. So if you're anywhere in Iowa, you're gonna be able to get there. And
so if you want to watch a guy with a beard and sometimes wearing bibs eat some pork tenderloin, you should check out his social media. I'm just watching a couple of the videos here, and looks like he's... These are some big sandwiches, too. These are not
They're huge. Like, small. The tenderloin usually is, like, way bigger than the bread. So they're
right.
Awesome.
It hangs out by a significant margin there. So
yes.
All right. Well, that'll do it for this week. Thanks for being here, Todd.
Thanks for having us, man.
So this week we talked about the Endangered Species Act, and impacts that we'll have on chemical labels moving forward, starting with Liberty Ultra. In our spotlight, we took a look at Loveland's Awaken Flow Boost, the 2024 Product of the Year from The Scoop. Ag History Minute, we talked about the history of the Endangered Species Act. Cool Beans this week was Nothing Beats a Glass of Cold Milk. Our That's Corny is hopefully the immigration situation will get worked out so migrant labor can return to farms that need it. And in our Feel Good Friday, J.J. Goodvin went on a pork tenderloin tour of all 99 counties of Iowa and picked his favorite. So thanks for listening. As always, happy farming.